What you know about layer 1 D5, greatest in the world, and they finally about to see why. What you know about XRD, I'm smart money, I ain't never on a decline. What you know about NFTs, it's not just ace, when you finally gonna realize. You need scalability, need more utility, then you better call on these guys. I'm going radical, I'm going radish, I'm going radical, I'm going radish. Hyperspeed D5, never on a decline, building the future, I feel like a savage.
Hello and welcome, I am Piers Ridyard, CEO of RDX Works, a core developer of the decentralized finance protocol Radix, a public ledger entirely focused on bringing DeFi into the mainstream. This is our podcast, The DeFi Download, a show about decentralized finance and all things crypto, where we dive into the details of the projects, assets, and services that are powering the DeFi revolution. Today, I'm joined by Gaurav, CEO of TDeFi, a Web3, metaverse, and crypto services incubator and advisor. TDeFi have incubated over 50 companies in the Web3 space, with a couple that have got over to $1 billion in market cap. Gaurav, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Piers, for having me.
So how long have you guys been around for? When did you guys get started?
So TDeFi as a company is just 2 years old, and it's a subsidiary of a larger group called TradeDog, which is an investment advisory for retail in crypto. But I've been in crypto since 2015, you know, mining, creating colos, setting up OTCs across Europe and the Gulf, and then investing ever since the first ICO, the DAO, and have never looked back. So yeah, my history with crypto is pretty old.
Interesting. The first ICO, the DAO.
The DAO, the DAO, yeah, DAO, and it was hacked. That was the reason of creation of Ethereum
Classic.
As in the
DAO,
chain.
That's the reason of the Ethereum the DAO. Classic, right.
Yeah, exactly.
That wasn't the first ICO. I mean, technically, Ethereum was the first ICO, right?
Yeah, I've had those debates over the last 7-8 years many a times, believe me, from the stage. But the moment you call Ethereum an ICO, believe me, the first crackdown is SEC. So never call that an ICO, believe me. Let's not make that public. Let's not give our reasons, more reasons to SEC.
I invested in the DAO as well when that came out. I think I put like 1,000 ETH or something like that into it, which, wasn't that much at the time. It feels like a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And
40,000 myself.
That was a fascinating period of crypto. What was your main takeaway from, because everyone takes something different away from it, what was your main takeaway of the DAO saga?
You know what? You're making me think today. Although at that time I was running at such a fast pace, I never really bothered. You'd be surprised to know, I participated in the ICO not through the smart contract, but through a Hong Kong-based exchange called Gate.io.
Right.
Not the present gate, but the gate, which was also hacked, and it's presently under litigation. I've been fighting it for the last 5 years. It was hacked and whatnot. But they finally, you know, because it was a centralized arrangement, they were the one who gave it to me after the final settlement was done, you know. So there was a cut down date of when you can claim your hacked Ethereums. Mm-hmm. And I just never did. I was running so fast at that point in life. I was practically building co-locations, mining setups, companies, cryptos, investments. Life was too fast. I mean, yeah, thank you for bringing it to me. So my takeaway as I would look back today was have your own audit team if you are... because I come from a 15 years of orthodox investing. I've been an angel investor and an incubator, a tech incubator for the last 14 years. So like I have to have an institutional take on this. I just don't have the luxury of simply blaming it to whatever, right? The blame is on me. The onus is on me. And I think, yes, if you're investing in crypto, the least you should know is the very, very tech details of the product. And having a smart contract auditor in your house, you know, in-house, if you're investing in millions a month, is a must. And this is a very interesting.
That was your takeaway. That was your takeaway.
Now, it is my takeaway today when you're talking to me, right? I told you very honestly. I didn't even think about it. Quite honestly, let me also give you a funny story because it's a podcast. You know, we have to make it entertaining. The day I got this email from the DAO that you have 40,000 ethers credited to your wallet. And because I absolutely stopped participating in that that exchange after that, you know, I was shocked, obviously, happily. And I was, I remember it was 7:30 p.m. In India at that time in my Indian office. I came out of my cabin. I went to the floor. It was a small 60 people office at that time. And I said, guys, we are leaving for Thailand this week. I'm throwing out a party. Like, all of you are going to Thailand. And Ethereum was $80 that day, right? So it was a pleasant shock. And by the time the trip was planned and we reached Thailand, I still remember the moment we landed and I checked my phone. Ethereum was 96. So I said, guys, the trip might just get cancelled because you have to pay. This is a loss. This is not a profit anymore. Yeah, funny stories of old day, old times.
Yeah, I mean, crypto, the volatility of crypto is a sight to behold. So you invested in the DAO, you were building co-locations, and you and sort of getting involved in sort of the infrastructure of crypto back then. So, like, 2 years ago, what was the opportunity that you guys saw for TDFi, and what made you decide to sort of actually start pursuing that then?
Very important question, actually. So while I was enjoying my beautiful life on the beaches of the world being a crypto VC, two things happened. One, you know, we scaled our trading operations immensely. We, you know, scaled to 30 screen traders, quite a few quants, and this was all personal money. So while we were running in hundreds of millions and operations were scaling, one thing, you know, the markets went down January 2018 and the, you know, Dow Jones crashed and the whole crypto started, you know, nosedive. And at that time, nothing worked. Like, all this infrastructure started to collapse. The trading setup was going on a bust. All of that was cracking down. So obviously by the end of 2019 and beginning of 2020, I should have, people like me usually commit suicide because I lost like almost 90% of my wealth. And I was contemplating on what went right and what went wrong. So for example, trading, which was our biggest business at that time, futures went wrong. Everything that was in spot, we were still holding it, you know, and we were pretty sure that they will rise because we betted on the right products, right? Polygon, Coty, Tron, these kind of projects, you know, Dot. So these kind of projects, the holdings were great. Futures were all collapsed, right? So futures was wrong. And then I looked at my investment portfolio because I was actually heading the investment side personally. Our investments were phenomenal. All the companies we invested in, they didn't run away. They didn't buy Ferraris. They spent their last bucks building the business that they committed to. They were sticking to their roadmap and white paper. But they failed. The best of them failed for silly reasons. And silly reasons like, as a entrepreneur, I know that it's pretty easy to solve it if someone's there to help you, someone's there to guide you. And while I was thinking about it, I saw that there's absolutely no structured advisory. Advisory as a company, advisory for reputation, advisory as a service in this industry. While there are, you know, enormous amount of advisors, everyone is an advisor in crypto. It's a funny joke that I often tell people. One of those consensus side meetings in 2018, I walked into a side party and I met with a guy like very well dressed suit, and I live in, you know, these clothes, you know, dry fits. So, and I asked him, what do you do in crypto? And he said, I'm an advisor.
Mm.
And I said, yeah, advisor is fine, but what do you do?
Mm.
And he said, what? I'm an advisor. I said, when did advisory become a full-time role?
Right.
And the second guy, the third guy, I met, the first five guys I met were all advisors.
Right.
So this is the funny truth of crypto, was and still is. So I said, okay, these guys can dump a project and will have nothing to lose because they don't have a life. They don't have a face to retain.
Right.
There is no company in the world that has a face to retain that would do it as a business and as a reputation.
Right.
That would have their skin in the game. So contemplating all these thoughts, I had numerous offers of being an advisor, but I always refrained from doing that because I know I can only do 1, 2, 3, or 4. And after that, I'll end up burning myself or devaluing myself. So I never took it. So yeah, that was the foundation thought. And at that time, my portfolio company Trade Dog came up with an idea of an accelerator TDFI, and they launched it only to have access to deals. But later on realized that it's a mess to deal with startup founders and they wanted to close it. And I said, guys, I am fine to take this on because this has been my business for more than a decade. And I want to do it in crypto because in the words of Larry Page and so many others from the Silicon Valley, if you bump into a problem that you know will only be solved if you solve it, you have found your business idea. So I thought, yeah, yes, I mean, enough of VC life. Let me prove myself in business also. And it has been, you know, 7-8 years at that time when I made my last business. So I'm a telecom guy. I made and sold telecom companies, advertising companies, tech companies. So yeah, that's how we landed onto TDFI.
So how does this differ from, you know, the shill in the suit in Consensus who will take, you know, a percentage of tokens to put his face on his website and promise you your website and promise you a bunch of introductions? What makes TDFI different?
Steve Jobs has a very famous video on YouTube, you can find it, where he explains how consulting is lame as a business without execution.
Yeah.
So any advisors and others who are only working for introduction are not advisors, they're networkers. So one, we qualify pretty well to do that. I told you, I've been here 24/7, 365, making multiple businesses at a time, obviously failing in some since 2015. How many people do you know who have done that? One.
I mean, it's an interesting video to quote, because what Steve Jobs is saying to the MBA class is, don't be a consultant because you need to own something. You need to
absolutely
own it,
exactly.
Right? But that's not what you're doing here. You're not owning the businesses. You're not getting involved in the day-to-day from the point of view of the long-term delivery. That's still down to the founders, right? You're not a founder. You're coming in and you're advising. So, like, what is it that...
You'd be surprised. Let me speak. You'd be surprised, I'm telling you. So I'll actually have an example. I have many examples, but I'll give you the best one, right? The feather on the hat. Vulcan Forge is an incubated company of ours. It touched a $1.4 billion market cap at its peak. There is no institutional backer in the company. There was no institutional backer up until last month. Skybridge Capital, Anthony Scaramucci, came in as one, right? But before that, like TDFI was the only institutional name behind the company. And they launched around last year, you know, more than 14 months ago. And even till date, they are present on our events. We have weekly calls. I mean, obviously, there are a few of them that are not attended by them, but our team is available on those calls. We have been on calls with all of their listing partnerships. We have scrutinized, negotiated most of their deals. We were there when the project was hacked. It's a podcast. I can't go on and reveal a lot of details here. The project went through multiple disastrous events of $120 and $140 million hacks, right? And the last message that I see on the group, of the common group, is 2 days ago when we are discussing the next steps of scaling their recent blockchain and, you know, bringing Metascapes to India. So yes, we are an advisory company, but we have some execution in-house. right? So for all the token engineering, for all the token business for and a life cycle, we also have the execution in-house. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, being an advisor, we're not like saying, okay, you do this, 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 and this. We're saying, okay, bring whatever is happening on a day-to-day basis to you, mm-hmm. and we'll bring our opinion, we'll do the research. We have analysts, we have researchers, we have everyone on board. We have tech guys, we have marketing guys. If an agency is pitching you to offer you marketing options, let it go through us. Because for you, it's your first, second, or fifth crypto company. Mm-hmm. For me, it's my 50th this month. Mm-hmm. I'm only talking about all the applications that we go through. I'm talking about the ecosystem that we have built. I'm talking about tons of companies that we talk to, not as an incubation, but as a potential partner to our incubated companies. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about my consulting arm, talking to the Fortune 500 mm-hmm. of the Gulf, of India, of the MENA region, of the Southeast Asia region. So the kind of perspective we bring on the table is immense. It's pretty tough for two founders sitting off a garage trying to win the world of their piece of tech.
Mm-hmm. So what are the biggest mistakes that you see founders make in sort of crypto, and that you spend a lot of your time helping people avoid?
The biggest problem in the real crypto projects, I think we both would agree that crypto is obviously an emerging tech market, an emerging tech product, and hence most of the founders are tech founders. And anyone who has, you know, maybe spent even 5 years in investing would agree to the builder's dilemma as one of the killing factors of any project. So tech founders tend to believe only in the power of the tech, the power of the product, which is not a reality. Marketing and sales is already a bigger reality in the equity world, while crypto only makes it a bit more complex, because now you have to understand another science, which is economics, which is how would you use the power of a publicly traded asset, in your strength? How would you engage that community through economics? Because token economics means the token is the foundation factor of economy. How many publicly traded assets have you managed in the market? How would the price of the asset influence your adoptability, your marketing altogether? You know, Ripple is one of the biggest cases. Since 2012, when they registered, till 2017, they were POC'd with three banks. After they touched the $3.2 value, they were, I think, $10 billion or $15 billion company. And everything changed in the next 6 months. They got integrated into 120-plus banks around the world and not POC. So your token value influences your valuation, and that changes everything in your marketing, in your presence, in your maturity. So we have to educate them about that. We have to give them examples. We have to run them through multiple cases of in-house projects, of external projects to help them bring and find execution and financial partners, co-founders. If not, we help them find them. Find a few, because we have a recruitment company in-house as well. Like I said, we are a consulting backed by execution.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we bumped into a problem that wasn't solved outside, we sort of started building the in-house strengths around that without depending on the external markets. So we help them find co-founders. We help them recruit a team. So most of the time they don't look at, it also scales to very, very personal problems.
Right.
They have scaling issues, they have team issues, they have co-founder psychological issues. And we deal with all of that to an extent where companies, I'm giving you a live example. I obviously can't name the project, mm-hmm. but a project that was launched around 6 months ago, beyond 6 months ago, we are still going on their weekly calls to talk to the last developer working out of India, working out of Ukraine, working out of Russia, and align them in a thought process. Because presenting the idea and raising fund and getting many tier one investors, which they thought were their biggest accomplishment, didn't actually work out in the next 4 months, right? And that is where we come in handy. So although people often get confused when we tell that we are an incubator, they would say, oh, well, if you're an incubator, you should only work till the launch. Well, talk to me. I'm a old guy. I mean, not old by age, but I'm a 15-year-old investor. For me,
you got the scars. It's been, it's, yeah. You've got the battle scars. It's been 50, you know, 5 years in crypto is 50
years.
7 years
in crypto, yeah. Imagine. So when I look at a project, no matter if you're a billion-dollar company or more, if you haven't got enterprise adoption, if you haven't got a product market fit, if you haven't really touched one-tenth of your market value in your revenues, you're really not an enterprise. You're still a startup and you need an incubation.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are masters of tokens, definitely one thing that we don't believe in is your market cap.
Right. So I'd like to talk about tokens a little bit more, but before we jump into that, by your definition, has anything in crypto reached product market fit?
Oh, wow. Oh, really? So many. Don't you think Ethereum has found its product market fit? It's insanity. The kind of adoption you're looking at for a tech, a lot of tech languages that are launched in the last 7 years haven't found that kind of adoption. Look at it. Don't plot it on its market cap, like I said. Uh-huh. Just look at it from a pure adoption and pure economics mindset.
Yes.
There were more than 20 languages and products, like high-grade products, launched by the largest enterprises of the Silicon Valley, if not anywhere else, during that time, and they haven't reached even a fraction of adoption.
So no, I don't think Ethereum has reached product market fit. Like the like speaking with users, who the majority of tokens are still bought by user base through exchanges. The majority of users do not interface with crypto with public ledgers directly. The main purpose of a public ledger like Ethereum is interactions with smart contracts, and on that access alone, the majority of users of these public ledgers tend to be a very small minority number of people who have highly specialist skill sets to be able to interact with things like DeFi and stuff like that. So do I think that Ethereum has found product market fit from the point of view of it being able to be adopted in the same way that the internet has been adopted, or that, you know, personal computing has been adopted, or mobile phone has been computed? No, it's not close. The user experience sucks. The number of hacks are ridiculous. The amount of difficulty in onboarding a single user is so high. The number of barriers to entry in terms of understanding how to use the technology is high. Like, takes the average person that, you know, I've onboarded multiple people individually, but also run this as like product interviews, and the average onboarding time is at least 2 hours to get someone up and running and using a public ledger, which is, you know, at the point where 95 to 99% of your funnel is dropping out. And what we're seeing is the small number of hardcore people who are like, yes, I want to be here for the tech, but that's not product market fit. That's your early adopters. And, you know, we all know from things like crossing the chasm that isn't product market fit, that's pre-product market fit.
So you've pushed me in a very hard situation where I'm actually talking to another tech founder who happens to be the host of the show I am on. So the last thing I want to get is to get into an argument with the host of the show.
Oh, I'm very happy. Please.
Yeah.
Please. No. Like, this is what makes these conversations interesting. So, yeah, argue the response.
Okay. So it's funny how perspectives behave, you know, how perspectives are in their true nature. Have you ever thought about the rest of the 3 billion population of the world that is unconnected to internet? Have you ever thought about the kind of time, energy, resources, infrastructure would be required to onboard the first guy from that 3 billion?
Sure.
You know, get them a computer, get them a mobile phone, get them whatever, connect it to internet, pay the cost of the bill,
sure.
Let it connect to a mobile infrastructure, an internet infrastructure,
sure.
Then teach them about all the things that have gone too complicated today. It's not just just not like booting like in a Windows XP or something, right?
Sure.
So you're only looking at it from the perspective of internet that has, you know, had quite a life cycle of multiple decades and has reached to this adoption level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I, if you can pull off my fulcrum or my point of reference, it was from all the other technologies launched at the time of Ethereum. Now, for example, I'm not saying it was launched. I'm just picking up a name. React.js mm-hmm. was around that time. Now, how many people do you think can, I mean, I can't go and code in React.js. I'm a tech guy. I can't do that. Most of the programmers of the world can't go out and use React.js. Has React.js found its product market fit? Yes, because its product, it's as an enterprise, as a company. Obviously, it's not. I'm saying if it was, it is doing what it was meant for, number one. Mm-hmm. It is addressing the solution. It's addressing the problem to which it was found to be a solution.
Yes.
And it is being used at the same time. And people are learning it to use it even further on a day-to-day yes. basis. Yeah. At the same time, if it was a corporate, I mean, there are many services, there are, you know, many companies using it and offering it as a service. They're all profitable doing it, and of everything Facebook is. So for, I'm sure there are many categorizations and people can find their own terms. And obviously I'm the last guy on the planet who ever believes in terms, but you know, for the better reference of people, I use the word product market fit. And then you came up with a new word for me, which is a pre-product market fit. Well, great. I mean, yes, but talk to me. I mean, there's a company that has pitched us last week. They raised $90 million in 2017. But they, again, classic case of not understanding what a publicly traded asset is. Their token got messed up big time, and it's, you know, I don't know, almost zero. And they are raising another $100 million, I mean, which is hard committed by the top line investors of the world. Why? Because the product has found their product market fit. Now, what, I mean, if Ethereum hasn't found their product market fit, how can you assume a company of 2017 finding its product market fit in blockchain and crypto? Well, it does. A lot of investors believe that it has. And I believe it has because it's doing $12 million in revenue and it's heavily EBITDA positive. You know, the future projections look great. Even the current ones are running into, you know, touching about a $50 million a year. Mm-hmm. Which is not bad at all mm-hmm. for a company 5 years old. So these are different definitions. People can live and die by them. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that if you compare it to all the popular technologies that were launched at that time that were meant for technologists to use, Ethereum was not meant for anything less than a technologist to use. Yes, you need to, I mean, there is a future where everyone has a MetaMask. Everyone knows how to maybe change between the networks and change between whatnot and whatnot. But yes, it is a specialized use case. You can't expect 7 billion people of the world to be using Ethereum tomorrow. Yes, like any other technology, like Python, like C#, like, you know, Java, which is the most adopted piece of tech, it just seamlessly becomes a layer and just seamlessly works behind the scene. As an, not as an interface, but as an enabler. Similarly, Ethereum's of the world and all the infrastructures and the future product market fits of blockchain will find their product market fit in the limitations of their technology capabilities and the kind of experts that are required to deal with that technology. It would never go out for the 7 billion people.
The question is whether or not the infrastructure is fit for purpose in the first place. Like, you know, there are lots of questions around generational infrastructure, you know, like GSM to 2G to 3G to 4G to 5G, whatever. And the extent and the transformational changes that happen in user experience. So for example, the Nokia range of mobile phones to the touchscreen range of mobile phones that Apple brought in, that completely changed what it meant to be a user of these platforms. And like from that point of view, I still feel like crypto is in the early 90s from internet age.
Absolutely.
Right? We haven't had our Netscape Navigator moment. We haven't had the sort of point where people are like, oh, I understand why I need crypto every day, right?
100% agree. That's why, you know, very cautiously I took the reference of the technologies of that time so that we can have the right references. I never compared it to internet, right? We are in the ice age of internet.
Yes.
Right? We are in the early 90s, as you said.
Yeah.
And let me also talk about one more point that you pointed out in the early discussion, which was the hacks and everything. Well, Ethereum hasn't been hacked. I mean, I'm not a pro Ethereum guy, by the way. If you talk to me, I do believe that there's a future
Ethereum
of better infrastructure.
Been hacked. Yeah, that's an interesting statement. So Ethereum hasn't been hacked would be like is like saying that I can't think of an analogy. Like Ethereum provides a bunch of tools. Those tools are Solidity and the EVM. And Solidity and the EVM routinely get exploited. Now, has Ethereum been hacked? I mean, if you have an exploit that's basically built into the programming language, there is a debate there as to whether or not Ethereum has been hacked.
4 months ago, Facebook paid $6 million to a bounty hunter.
Right. Right. But
by far the most adopted internet app.
Right, but we're talking about a technology that is responsible for financial products rather than a technology that's...
Oh, well, Facebook isn't?
Not from the point of view of if it goes wrong, hundreds of millions of dollars of end users' funds go disappear. So, like, you know, the Ethereum hasn't been hacked from a tight crypto economic point of view. Yes, I agree with you. No one's double spent Ethereum. No one has, you know, like that kind of thing. But, you know, from a tool set, terrible record, you know.
Absolutely. And I'm sure anyone and everyone who... I keep giving this example to a lot of people. I don't know if we have time, but can I like give just a stupid, an example of my child age? So my uncle used to run a franchise, a bike, motorbike franchise, of a company that was Hero Honda, right? It is the most popular bike in India. It's a partnership between an Indian and Japanese Honda company.
Heard of it.
And then there was a local Indian bike maker called TVS.
Yeah.
And they had, and my first friend, my best friend, had the franchise of TVS.
Mm.
And TVS sold like probably a fraction of bikes Hero Honda sold in the country.
Right.
And I'm talking about my childhood, right?
Right.
My high school. And I used to visit both of them because one was my uncle, one was my best friend. And I used to see like the service center of Hero Honda having 200 bikes every day for servicing. And this friend of mine used to deal with like 8 of them. And I said, dude, the quality of bikes TVS is making is insane. They don't even come to the service center. And these guys are so messed up. They're cleaning, like, you know, they're servicing bikes every second.
Right.
Only to realize in the next 8 years when I started my, you know, real big businesses that because Honda is selling like 100 times more bikes, they have more complaints, right? And not the other way around.
Right.
So listen, when a product will be adopted, when the use cases would expand, when the community would expand, when there's a bigger bounty for the winner, that's when things get hacked. An exchange that had just started from the corner of Somalia or wherever won't get hacked. But, you know, I'm sure Binance gets an attack every second.
Yeah. Yes and no, right? Like, Solidity and the way you architect smart contracts in Ethereum and on other ledgers is objectively bad. Like,
absolutely.
So like,
because it is the first one.
Because it's now the first one. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm totally agreeing to that. I'm saying there's a better future. I told you, please don't take me as a pro Ethereum or a pro, you know, an old age guy that believes in old age tech.
Right.
I'm saying there are going to be the best of the best infrastructures in time. I mean, Move is so promising. Look at
Move is the wrong direction as well. Like they're all
okay.
They're
RDX all... is amazing. I don't know nothing about it, but
this is a topic that I go deep on. But like, yeah, like these approaches are wrong. These approaches are wrong because the ledgers don't understand what assets are, and like until a public ledger understands that they are moving assets and not just passing messages, which is what everyone's doing at the moment, you are going to continually get the kind of hacks and exploits that you get. Anyway, we will move off this topic because in the end of this, what I want to talk about is token economics. Because you said you've mentioned token economics and the importance of token economics a couple of times,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And the what you're saying is you guys take a different view on how to build token economics than most of the advisors that you see in the space. So I'd Absolutely. Love if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Okay. I think that tokenomics is the most abused word in crypto in the last 2 years. From understanding, going through a white paper and understanding the transaction that entail a fee, and then understanding the velocity of the token within the economy, which is, you know, currency, as it moves in the economy, makes it wider, you know, why there is a reserve currency of a country and a reserve currency of the world, only because of the economics around it and the way, you know, it moves. Velocity is important, holding is important, fees and transactions are important. But I bet you, and everyone who's listening to this, talk to a project that claims, you know, to be the best around the corner and has tier one investors and whatnot, and just ask them for their tokenomics. Simple test, you know, send them a text saying, please send me your tokenomics. And they'll send you a one pager with a pie chart that distributes 100% of their token supply into investor marketing, this, that, and those. Is that the economics of a token, really? No. I mean, token is the foundation of the economy right. that is projected on the top of the tech. Right. Obviously, tech is an enabler. Don't forget, we are the people and crypto of people of crypto are not there just for the tech. The reason crypto has taken off is because there's an economy on the top, mm-hmm. right? It's the financial angle, it's the benefit angle, it's the transparency. All of that is a part of the larger economy. Look at it as a country. Every project is a country if you may think of it, right? You have to think about so many moving parts. How does the currency of the country pegs the growth of the country, the movement of the country, the services of the country, the taxes of the country, everything, and even the foreign affairs of the country to that currency, mm-hmm. right? Why don't people look at the token of that economy as in the same format? I'm not saying everyone. I'm sure there are so many experts of my time that have been burned of this perception. So tokenomics today, what it means is this pie chart of 100% supply and the segregation amongst the team, the treasury, the investors, the Series A, Series B, I mean, the seed, the private and the public rounds and whatnot sure. and yeah, other whatever, stupidities, right?
Yeah,
right? Distribution. Whatever. Distribution, exactly, of tokens. So we had to find a better word, because if we'll go out and market ourselves as the tokenomics expert, people will, you know, will find it tough to deal with us. So we call it token engineering, which is a better suited word. And we also go out to explain what it means. So we go into the product. I'll have to repeat that we come from a 14-year background of investing and startup incubation. So we know how a business works, functions, and our equity companies have gone into IPO stages. So we have seen the life cycle and then the post-life cycle, I mean, the life cycle of the product and the asset post-listing. So we look at it from the horizon of 10 years of how this token would function as the fulcrum of the economy. How many use cases do we have to bring in right there at the foundation level, at the smart contract level? And then how many use cases can we create to create an external integration to economy, you know, an integration to external economies? Then how many reasons can we give for that currency of that economy to be held by people for one or the other reason? Because although we have been successful to fool the regulators of a lot of jurisdiction by the term token utility mm-hmm. and a utility token, but at the same time we are still fighting a war where tomorrow any regulator who educates themselves enough will crack down on all these not so utility token economy.
Right.
So there has to be very, very viable reasons of your holders to hold it in the time to come. And this holding will create charts and will create your token, make your token investable and institutional. When the right holding is created over the first 3 years, the next few years become sort of announce or narrate the future of that digital asset. So, for example, why would Fidelity include your token in their next bundle offering or the bundle product for their investors of penny stocks of crypto? Mm-hmm. Why would Blackstone consider your token in the next offering to their clients? Why would you be a part of the top 100 ETF, mm-hmm. You know, a high-risk ETF of the future? So all of that would depend on your chart, on your chart. Chart is as immutable as blockchain itself. I know it's not a reality, but it is as immutable and as public a reality of your project.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how many tech-centric founders or even marketing-centric founders or even finance-centric founders talk about this in crypto.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for me personally, it's a shame to the industry. We are all a publicly traded asset and nobody talks about it. So we bring that necessary education. We work on their business again with them. We tell them all these details. And obviously, this is a very philosophical angle. So it's tough to make them educated enough on a philosophy for them to live it immediately. So we have to get on numerous calls for hours and hours, present them cases, and then obviously convince their board with a future projection of all of that. So it's a lot of hard working that goes into that. And then because the plan, the initial plan was plotted by us, we also sort of manage the future of the token after launch around that. We align the exchanges, we align the launch pads, we align the investors according to the product release roadmap, and hence the vesting schedules on the top of it, and a gazillion other features. So we execute it for the next 1 year, 5 year, 10 years.
So let's drill down. So what's the clearest example of a well-executed token engineering or engineered token you can think of that sort of like ticks?
If you won't ask me for reasons, because most of the companies, my friend, including the founder, I think Binance is the most amazing example.
Right.
And please don't ask me for reasons. This, I can't make it in public.
Right. So, I mean, like, obviously it's easy, it's easy to see why, but do you, so the
look at the charts of Binance for the first 3 years during the worst markets. I mean, look at the charts.
Yeah.
I, with the little institutional investing I know, BNB happens to be my first option.
Right.
You know, my first option to be held in the portfolio.
Right. But I mean, it means it's obviously because the success of BNB is inextricably linked to the success of Binance, and gives a lot of use incentives that sort of help drive the flywheels underlying the business. I mean, just taking an example outside of crypto, Jeff Bezos talks about this a lot in, you know, when he's talking about building Amazon, where he's looking at what are the flywheels of the business that you can add, where you can go, if we add these features, for example, Prime shipping, then we massively increase our hardcore user base, and our hardcore user base is where like 90% of our revenue comes from, right?
Exactly.
So that's really interesting, but then that runs into the separate issue you're talking about, which is sort of like making these things more like security instruments. And I think that there's sort of like a very difficult, and this is part of the reason I asked the question about product market fit, right? Is that it's I think that in the early days of crypto, a lot of token engineering was specifically around this. How does the utility of the platform, when used, directly benefit the token holders?
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. But then, exactly.
But that move, because of the regulatory landscape, I think the
it's coming back again. People are the only utility people can think of on their project, and I'm actually ashamed to say that they end up raising tens of millions of dollars with that shitty utility, which exactly makes them a security on the first day, is that they'll buy back the tokens of the revenue.
Right.
I mean, you're trusting on humans again. You're not at all smart contract oriented. There is no foundation, but a for-profit company that actually takes out their profit first and then goes out in the market to buy off the tokens,
right,
which is also a very predictable angle of the markets, not at all dependable by investors, makes you only look shittier. And the velocity is terrible in these projects, and they eventually die off.
Right. So when you're thinking about these token, let's take app examples on top of public ledgers. Do you think that there's anyone? Do you subscribe to the Curve model, for example? Do you think the Curve model is a good model
It is a fairly good model. I know there are a lot of arguments, and I'm not a big believer of Axie Infinity. I know everyone's saying it's a failed model of token economics, but I would say it was an amazing model of onboarding the idea of play to earn, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the stepping stones of the industry. Mm-hmm. Axie Infinity was a brilliant tokenomics idea to onboard the industry, because you can't onboard an industry that is already profitable unless you sort of crack into it, and the crack into it was through the users. Mm-hmm. So just because Play to Earn started onboarding so many users is what excited the game industry to come into Web3, right, and not the other way around. There is not enough capital, if you know. There's not enough capital in Web3 as much as it is in the real world for gaming companies.
Right. If you
remember, Slack is made of a gaming company. You know,
sure.
Slack had, the gaming company had so much money that they started refunding their investors, and that's when XL Partners told them that we don't want the money back. You have the team, you have the idea, you have the motivation. You just don't have a business idea, right? I want you to spin off a company over that setup.
Right.
So, gaming companies have a lot of capital there. But because the right tokenomics onboarded so many freaking users and the valuations went off the roof, that the marketing around that sort of delusioned everyone else.
Yeah, I think there's a great saying in Y Combinator, which is growth solves almost any problem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that's sort of like the underpinning, right? I mean, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, Gaurav. If people want to get in touch with you or want to apply to your accelerator, what should they do and how should they reach out?
So we are an incubator. Sorry to correct you here. Accelerator, yeah, and Lifetime Advisory. So we don't leave the hand of the project. And TDE.fi, pretty simple. TDFI is the name, and TDE.fi is the website. The application form's there. We're pretty approachable on our socials, but website is the best way to reach out to us.
Awesome. So that's T for Tango, D for Delta, E for Echo, .fi, Foxtrot India. Gaurav, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And looking forward to catching up with you again soon.
Amazing conversation with a lot of spices. Thank you, Pierre, for pulling that off. And a good show. Thank you so much. You better call on these guys. I'm going radical. I'm going radish. I'm going radical. I'm going radish. Hyperspeed DeFi, never on a decline. Building the future, I feel like a savage.